The Gospel of Mark is a very unique book, very unique in the Gospels. It is a very hurried account. The word immediately showing up gives us over and over, gives us just this kind of rushed feeling. And what Mark is doing is he's kind of hurrying up to get to the point of Christ's death, when he's going to slow down and show how people suffer, how Christ suffered, and how others will be called on to suffer as well. But it's interesting to me that although Mark does somewhat hurry through much of the life of Jesus, he takes the opportunity to express several occasions where Jesus has dealings with those who are demon-possessed. Now, a few of those, again, in Mark's style, are just kind of hurried through. Mark just mentions that Jesus is casting out demons. But there's three locations within the book of Mark where Jesus is taking some time, and Mark is taking the time to tell us about those. And I think it gives us some very interesting things to think about. Some things in relation to Jesus and evil, some relations between ourselves and evil. And so this evening, what I'd like for us to do is to take a look at those three accounts within the book of Mark where we're told a great deal, at least, I guess, by biblical standards in dealing with demon and possession, where Mark gives us information about these occasions. But as we do that, I think it's very important for us, before we look at those three accounts, to kind of get an overview, to talk about two major ideas that will help us as we understand a little bit better what these three things are teaching us. And the first of those is actually our thoughts about evil. When we think about evil, we need to understand that its goal is to destroy us. That's what evil is wanting to do. And so as you and I think about our struggle, it is quite literally, spiritually speaking, a life or death situation. As we consider that, I want you to think about a passage that occurs very near the beginning of the Bible. You'll remember that Cain is tempted. He's had his offering rejected. He's not dealing well with that. His feelings are all askew. And the Lord comes to him and says to him, "Why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted?" And then pay particular attention to the next phrase when he says, "And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it." It's so interesting to look here and to see how that God, in a sense, is personifying sin, and it's almost like the criminal who's waiting just around the corner ready to pounce. And he's telling Cain, you've got to understand that. Evil wants to destroy you. We go almost to the other end of the Bible, and God does the same thing through the writings of Peter. As Peter here is talking about the devil, a very familiar reading, but consider it in relation to what we're talking about this evening, when he says, be sober-minded, be watchful, your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. You hear those Genesis words in there? To Cain, he said, sin is crouching at the door. Peter saying to his audience, Satan is crouching, ready to pounce, ready to destroy. We've got to understand that, because I believe that's one of the chief reasons that we find these accounts of demon possession within the Gospel of Mark. The second point we need to understand, as we think about the goal of evil is to destroy, we understand the purpose of Jesus is to destroy evil. What we're seeing here is the battle being played out of good versus evil, and good's going to win. And as Christ comes to earth, and as he has occasion in dealing with these demons, that's exactly what he's pointing out to us. Think about what John writes over in 1 John 3 and verse 8, when he says, whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil, for the devil has been sinning from the beginning. Now pay particular attention to this verse. The reason the Son of God appeared was for what? Was to destroy the works of the devil. Evil seeks to destroy. Jesus is going to destroy evil. If we can get those two points down, these three occasions we're going to look at make a whole lot more sense. God has given us very little information on demon possession. As we mentioned this morning, usually a study of it brings more questions than it does answers. But I believe this evening, if we'll approach our study from this angle with these two things in mind, I believe we can see some of what God is seeking to tell us. So let's look at these occasions, beginning first of all in Mark chapter 1. Mark chapter 1. And as we look at this first account, I want us to understand that here we're dealing with a demon that has no real respect for location. In fact, let's just read the account here and then we'll talk about it. Beginning with me in verse 21 of Mark chapter 1. It says, "And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue," Jesus, of course, here, "entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, 'What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God.' But Jesus rebuked him, saying, 'Be silent and come out of him.' And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him, and they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, 'Who is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him.'" What we'll see as a fairly consistent thread anytime we have Jesus dealing with those who are possessed by demons is that the demon is fully aware of Jesus. After all, he's had some experience with him before, hasn't he? We think about the demons, whatever they are, they were not created as wicked. They were not created as evil, but made the decision to rebel against God. And because of that, they know who Jesus Christ is, and they call him out as the Holy One of Jesus, the Holy One of heaven, Jesus, the Son of God. And as we consider that, we understand that they also realize what Jesus can do. They understand the destruction that he's going to bring. But as we think about this particular demon, I believe one of the more interesting features of this account is where all of this is taking place. If we're not careful, we read right over that. We get to the section where he's being cast out, but we forget that all of this is taking place within the synagogue, the holy place, so to speak, where they've come together to worship God, to reason, to study together. And right in their midst is this man who is possessed by a demon. I want us to consider that idea as we think about our own relationship with evil. Because I believe one of the lessons that we get from this is that when we look at where the demon is, we understand very clearly that the demon did not view certain areas as being off limits. Even though the synagogue was a place where they came together to do holy things, the demon was right there with them. We understand that today demon possession is not the problem, but we understand that evil still seeks to overtake us, that the devil is still crouching like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And just as was the case in the first century, so you and I may find evil following us into the holy places. Let me illustrate what I mean by that. I believe an example of that would be when we think about those who would dispute and disturb and distort the message of God. That as God presents His divine word and says, "This is what I expect, this is what I want, this is who I am," there are those who go into that holy place, allowing evil to have control over them, so to speak, and they pollute the very things that God has presented in purity. Consider a few ideas with me along that line. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 15 is no stranger to us, is it? Where the Lord says, "Beware of false prophets." Why? Because they come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. And so here is someone who the Lord is saying they're going to look good, they're going to appear good, they're going to speak to you in things that you think are good, but you better be careful because evil is crouching at the door. Evil is seeking its way to destroy you. Consider as well what Peter wrote concerning this in 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, when he warns this, "But false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them. bringing upon themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their sensuality. And because of them, the way of truth, what? Will be blasphemed. Why? Because evil is crouching at the door. Here are those who secretly make their way in, who become a part of a group, but their entire purpose is not only to destroy, but even to deny their very master, even to say that Jesus Christ is somewhat limited. One other we might look at is Paul wrote to Timothy. He told him in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1, "Now the Spirit expressly says that in later times some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits," and listen to his words here, "and teachings of demons." Isn't that an interesting phrase? The apostle is saying there are going to be those in the later times that are going to be driven by the motivation of evil. Not that they're possessed like these people in the first century, but in the fact that they are allowing the wickedness, the corruption of the Word of God, to take the message completely off track, and in so doing, to lead people astray. There's a reason why God warns us over and over and over about false teachers. He says that evil is seeking its foothold in the holy places. Now, what's an outcome of that? When we think about an outcome of the false teaching, one of the things we're going to see is corrupted worship. Here the Lord has said, "I am God, I am King, and as your God and your King, I have full right to explain to you how I want to be worshiped." But yet, what does evil do? Evil seeks to displace that. Notice with me an example that we find with the children of Israel. Now I realize this is a bit different situation, but I believe there's a point to be made. Looking back to Deuteronomy chapter 32, it's describing the corruption of their worship, their religion. Moses says they stirred him to jealousy with strange gods, talking about God here, Jehovah. "With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded." Moses says one of the big problems is you allowed evil to control you. You allowed evil to come in and to make the claim in your life that Jehovah God is not the true God, that you can worship any and all of these pagan gods. And he says because of that, God, Jehovah, is jealous. And the same thing is true for us when we allow evil to convince us that we need to change the plan of God. I want us to think about that in relation to some things that Jesus actually said with corrupted worship. Listen to Mark chapter 7 as he's talking about the Pharisees. This one does have relevance to us. When he said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me.'" Why? "In teaching the doctrines and commandments of men." Would you listen to his wording there? He says, when you are allowing the ways of God, the worship of God, to become corrupted, what you're doing is you're violating the doctrines and the commandments of God by pursuing those doctrines and commandments of men. One other idea that the apostle speaks to us over in the book of Colossians chapter 2. Listen to how he explains when things get off track like this. He says, "If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world," why? "As if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch," referring to things that all perish as they are used according to human precepts and teachings. "These have indeed an appearance of wisdom," and promoting what? Promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgences of the flesh. He's describing here a host of things that are still with us in corrupted worship today. And what does he say about it? He says these are self-made religions. They're no good. They're crouching at the door, and they're destroying. One other example we might note. Not only false teaching, not only corrupted worship, But I believe we also see a foothold of evil in the holy places when it comes to relationships with brethren. Sometimes we may be getting the doctrine right, and we may be getting the worship right, but the attitude that we have for one another is totally, totally wrong. I want you to listen to what the Lord has to say about this. Let's go over to the book of 1 John. You can keep your place here in Mark if you'd like. We'll be back. But look over to 1 John. And as we look in this epistle, beginning in chapter 2, down in verse 11, listen to what John has to say. We're going to read three verses here that basically say the same thing, just in a little bit different way. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 11, he says, "But whoever hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he is going because the darkness has blinded his eyes." We look in chapter 3, over to verse 15. What do we find? "Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him." Chapter 4 and verse 20. "If anyone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen." Sometimes evil follows us into the holy place. Our relationship with one another is one of the holiest relationships we can have. We are brethren. We are sons of God. We are children of the Father. And John is saying to us, if you allow this wickedness to creep in, this evil to come in, it's going to destroy you. That's what we have to think about. And so, anytime we're tempted to have evil thoughts about our brother, we must realize we are allowing evil into the holy places. We could go on with other examples. But I believe as we look at these, we understand that what we learn from this first account in casting out a demon in the book of Mark, that God is showing us that you've got to have your guard up all of the time. Let's look at a second example. This is one I hope that's familiar to everyone who was here this morning, because this is what the lesson was about. As we think about Jesus dealing with the demon Legion, we're going to Mark chapter 5 this time. And I'm not going to take time to reread this entire account, although I do want to remind us that as we look at this, we see the destructive power of the wicked that's within him. And you'll recall, in fact, we might just note verse 3, in talking about the possessed man, it says he lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. We look at this, and then very much in common with the first account, when the demon comes into contact with Jesus, he immediately acknowledges him as the Holy One, the Son of God, running to him, bowing before him. Why? We well know what Jesus has the power to do. And so too did this demon. And so what do we find in this? The demon was fully aware of Jesus' purpose and fully aware of who he was. What he knew is that Jesus had come to destroy evil. The demon, being evil, knew that that meant him, that he was being sent back to the abyss. But yet as we consider this, I believe we also see the destructive nature of evil. Look at what he did to the man. In each of the accounts that we read about with demon possession, what we're finding is the demon is having a very bad physical impact. Really, what the demon is doing, and part of this is somewhat of the mystery of demon possession, the demon is seeking to destroy the one who's playing host. This comes out very clearly when this legion of demons ask Jesus to dispel them into the herd of swine. And as we look down to verse 13, we'll recall what happened. "The unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea." That's what they desire to do. Evil seeks to destroy us. Now, once again, this account is here for our learning. And as we think about this, I hope we get the point that evil is seeking to bring about our destruction. This is something that had better not be disassociated for any of us. For every one of us, we must understand that the purpose of evil is to destroy. It may not be like the first century demon possessions, but nonetheless, evil is there to destroy. Let's illustrate that by going back to the very beginning. Go with me to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. The grand story of creation here is God is speaking the world into existence. He's describing man as man has been created as the apex of creation, better than anything that's been created thus far. We look in verse 27, and it says, "So God created man in His own image. In the image of God He created him. Male and female, He created them." What a beautiful picture. Our creation, we were made in the image of God. Turn just a few pages over to Genesis chapter 6. Number of years passing by as we turn these pages. Generations have followed Adam and his treacherous sin. They have committed sin. And we come down to verse 5. With chapter 127 still ringing in our ears, let's listen to what he says beginning in verse 5. "The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart." Between Genesis 1 and Genesis 6, we went from a picture of man created in the image of God to man who had allowed evil to destroy him. To the point that God is going to say, "I'm going to wipe them out, everyone, with a great flood." As we understand that, we understand that really the purpose of evil as we see at the beginning and as we continue to see throughout the Bible is that it is seeking to destroy that likeness to God. Now, when a demon possessed someone, there was nothing godly there. There was not a love for God. There was not a desire to please Him. There was not a desire for life, because evil destroys. And that's what the New Testament writers warn us about as we look through the pages. Let's look at just a couple of examples of that. Go with me to 1 Timothy chapter 1. 1 Timothy chapter 1. And as we look down to Paul's writings concerning this very thing, listen to what he says as we begin in verse 6 of chapter 1. He says, "Certain persons, by swerving from these, have wandered away into vain discussion, desiring to be teachers of the law without understanding either what they are saying or the things about which they make confident assertions. Now we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully, understanding this, that the law is not laid down for the just, but for the lawless and disobedient." Now listen to the description here. "For the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who strike their fathers and mothers, for murderers, the sexually immoral, men who practice homosexuality, enslavers, liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. These are the people who have allowed evil to destroy them. These are the people who were created in the image of God, but yet what they have done is they have dismissed that and they have pursued evil as a result." Note one other writing of Paul with me over in Ephesians chapter 2. As we look in Ephesians chapter 2, going down to verse 1, he's describing here the previous condition of these Christians, but it makes our point for us. He says, "And you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now in work at the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind." What Paul is not saying is that we didn't have a choice about it, What he's saying is we've become like everybody else. So what happened? As we think about the destruction of evil, as we think about evil's desire to change us from the likeness of God to the likeness of evil, what we understand is that it began when our thoughts started centering on wicked ideas. That's where it all started. Remember Genesis 6? Where the Lord is saying every thought of their minds was on evil continually. What impact did that have? Well, that changes your motives. If your mind is thinking on evil thoughts, on non-godly thoughts, you have no desire for the proper motives about what you're to do. What happens when your motives get messed up? Your words do not speak reverence. You teach false doctrine. You corrupt worship. You speak in the ways of the world. And when all of that happens, our actions do not reflect His glory. Sometimes when someone has committed an ungodly act, you might hear a statement such as, "I just don't know how it happened to me." Well, here's how. Our thoughts become corrupt, our motives become corrupt, our words become corrupt, our actions become corrupt, and rather than pursuing godliness, we're walking in the ways of the very one who wants to destroy us. And I believe that's a lesson we gain from the Legion, from his association not only with Jesus Christ, but what he was seeking to do in the one who played host. Let's look at the third example. We're returning back to the book of Mark and going over this time to chapter 9. Mark chapter 9 is another intriguing account, somewhat strange account as all of these are, where a man has brought his son to have a demon cast out. Jesus is not with the disciples at this time, but is away. And let's see what happens. Pick up with me in verse 17. Jesus has now walked back onto the scene, and someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute, and whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, trying to kill him here, I believe, and he fell down on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into the fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for the one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw the crowd running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of it and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and he was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. What we understand about this is that Jesus had no problem controlling demons. Remember, while evil's purpose is to destroy, Jesus' purpose is to destroy evil. He had no problems, but his disciples did. Here, the man had brought his son to these disciples, and what we find is that they are unable to control the spirit. Did you notice what Jesus said to them? As he comes up, he's speaking to them, and it seems to everybody in his hearing in verse 19, when he calls them a faithless generation. "How long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you?" And if we go to the very end of the account, we find Jesus telling them exactly why they're having such problems, because they ask. And if you look in verse 29, he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer." Some translations, fasting and prayer. Jesus is saying to his disciples, "You've underestimated the power of strength, the power of evil." And in this, we have our lesson. Because like those disciples, that many times can be a problem for us. We underestimate just how strong evil can be. Go with me over to the book of Ephesians, chapter 6. We oftentimes come to this chapter to read about the armor of God that He promises to His faithful here. But we do ourselves a great disservice when we don't read the preface to that we find beginning in verse 10. Paul writes this, "Finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the whole armor of God." Why? "So that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil." You ever thought much about verse 12? "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over the present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm." You know what Paul says? He says, "You have no idea what's going on around you. You have no idea the cosmic battle that's underway for your destruction." And as you start reading the implements of this armor, this is not childhood stuff. Though we oftentimes teach it to our children, we cut out our little shields and our little swords, this is serious armaments that we're called to put on. Because the apostle is saying, evil will destroy. And it can destroy because it is strong. So what's the problem? The disciples had the problem of self-confidence. They were considering themselves to kind of be the source of the power. And the problem was they weren't looking to God. They weren't crediting God with the strength and the power to overcome. They were trusting in themselves, thinking they were strong and failing as a result. Does that describe us? How many times do we fall to a temptation because we have underestimated its power? I can watch that movie. The nudity, the profanity is not going to have any impact on me. I can hang around with this group of folks. Their dirty jokes aren't going to harm my mind. Their actions and what they do aren't going to bother me. I can go to these websites. Those things don't bother me. And what are we doing? What we're doing is we are underestimating what evil is seeking to do to us. We are naive and we are ignorant when we are thinking that we can do all of this stuff and it's going to have no impact whatsoever. And as the problem for the disciples, so is the problem for us. So, let's go over just a bit to Colossians chapter 3. And I want you to note what the apostle says to the Colossians. When he says in verse 1, "If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth, for you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. For when Christ," and I want you to listen to this phrase, "when Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with Him in glory. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you: sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry." Here's how you live. Here's how you survive in this war against evil. It's having the faith that God has the power to control it. What if Cain had simply said, "Lord, help my weakness"? His story would have been very different. And that can be our story. A story not of a people who are taken in and deceived and arrogantly say, "We can control it all ourselves." But a people of faith who realize our own weaknesses and we cast ourselves into the protective hands of God. And when Jesus tells His disciples, "You need to have faith," He's telling His disciples now, that you need to have faith also. So as we think about these three accounts, let's remember two things. Standing with evil puts us in the company of those who are going to be destroyed. Matter of fact, when you study the Bible, if you stand with evil, evil is going to be destroyed, and you along with it. But what a more blessed thought when we understand that standing with Christ means that we are standing with the one who victoriously will triumph over evil. And by His grace and His goodwill, you and I can stand with Him. The days of demon possession are gone. But yet we understand that today evil is very much with us. And as God told Cain, so He tells us, evil desires to control you, but you must control it. As Peter tells us, the devil, like a roaring lion, is seeking to devour, but we can overcome. And maybe tonight this study of those who had these firsthand experiences with evil in extreme forms have encouraged you that you don't want to be counted amongst that number, that you want to be on the side of the victorious. That can be done when you surrender to God. Buried in the waters of baptism, renouncing sin, and in so doing, having your sins washed away, you rise up no longer on the camp, in the camp of evil, but rather in the camp of God. But if you've allowed evil to control you, there's still hope. And if we can pray with you for strength, for forgiveness, whatever you need, let every one of us be able to pillow our heads this evening by saying, I am convinced that if the Lord returns this evening, I'm ready to meet Him. And come, Lord Jesus.